Okay, can I be heard? Okay, good. Let's see. Oh yeah, I'll just before announcements, I'll go around and greet people on Zoom, and then people in the Zendo will introduce themselves. Starting with Dave B. Paula. Amelia,
Amelia,
Christina,
Christina,
Rosemary,
Rosemary,
and I'm, you want to unmute and say your name? B S E W S?
well
Brandon,
done.
there we go. Brandon, hello.
Brandon,
James,
James,
Jim, Brian,
Brian,
Ellen, Lori.
Lori.
Mary, Victor, Dave Q, Betty, Karen, Bob, Mark, and Ruth Ann, and in the Zendo, Michael, Kazu, Dennis, Linda, Alice, and Domio. All right. I can't think of too many announcements. Precept study continues on Tuesday. Jukai is on June 5th. There is a 1-day retreat next month as well. Yeah. Any questions about what's coming up? Or oh, Vesak, thank you. yes. Okay, so not next Sunday, but the Sunday after. So I guess that's the 10th, I think. We will have the Vesak ceremony, which is the festival of the Buddha's birth. So it's very sweet. Before lockdown, we were building up the ceremony when people bring kids, because it's a fun ceremony for kids, and so people are welcome to do that again. But let's see. So it will happen in place of our morning chanting service. So it'll start at 9:30 Pacific time. It might end up going a little longer than our chanting service usually does, but you know, not too much longer. And we have a little statue of the Buddha and a bower of flowers, and we pour sweet tea over the Buddha's head and stuff like that. So I'm figuring, well, for the Zoom, we will hopefully like set up a camera so it's really close in on the Buddha altar, and you can see the baby Buddha getting bathed with sweet tea. So please attend that if you are interested. And if you are local and you're planning to come, there will be an announcement in the newsletter, but you should bring flowers. All right. Let's get started then. Today's talk is an answer to a question that was submitted during the Q&A session a couple weeks ago. How do I know if my practice is languishing? And when I looked up the word languish, it's just perfect. It's the perfect word for this kind of question. Because to languish means to be or become weak or feeble, to lose vigor and vitality, or to undergo neglect, or experienced prolonged inactivity, or to be subjected to delay or disregard, or to be ignored. So I thought that's very, like, it's definitely possible for our practice to languish at times. But I think part of what is behind this question is the fact that it's also usually not helpful to set up ideals and expectations and, you know, judge and measure our practice, that's usually not helpful either. So yeah, anyway, so negotiating that is what I'm going to talk about today. And I think, I think there's going to be plenty of time for discussion. So just to prompt you for that, please, like, be prepared to, you know, chime in, reflect, ask questions, share when I'm done. So how do I know my practice is languishing? And I think we might be on either two ends of this. I think it's fine, but maybe it's actually languishing and I'm fooling myself. Or I think it might be languishing, but maybe I'm just getting stuck in duality and making a problem where it doesn't exist. So how do we recognize when it is languishing, and how do we do something about it without falling into duality? So my basic answer is, if you wonder whether your practice is languishing, it probably is. But I should say, it's normal and natural to go through cycles where sometimes your practice is more lively and engaged and active, and sometimes where it languishes a little bit. So what we're looking for, whenever there's some kind of issue or tension, it's useful to remember that our way, the Buddhist way, is the middle way, where we're trying to avoid getting stuck in extremes. So then the valuable thing is to ask, well, what are the extremes in this case? So I would say one extreme is complacency, where we think there's nothing to be gained. Practice is all just about accepting what is. I shouldn't judge or strive, get caught up in that. My practice is good enough as it is, or it's as good as it's going to get. Or maybe I don't want to push myself and get wrapped up in, you know, feelings of dissatisfaction or inadequacy or something like that. So we just go, eh, good enough. So that's one extreme, complacency. And the other extreme, striving. Constantly comparing the reality of our practice to what we know is possible, or to ideals, whether those are ideals from someone else or ideals from ourselves, within ourselves, or what we see in others, what we've read about, a sense of falling short, judging ourselves, feeling frustrated or inadequate, or maybe just quietly ashamed. So neither of these extremes results in much, I hesitate to say progress in practice, but, you know, movement, growth, development in practice. I mean, if you have to fall one way or another, I might say striving might be a little bit fruitful, just because the nature of our practice is such that it tends to deconstruct delusion. So maybe you're kind of striving and you know you're striving, but chances are good that you'll still learn some stuff along the way, and maybe even end up being able to let go of the striving. But generally, it is possible to get very stuck in that sense of duality. So the middle way is a third option. It's a vital and dynamic path of just not getting stuck in extremes. So it's not a fixed position. It's not a, you know, this is exactly how the middle way looks. It's more of, you know, being real, but of not getting stuck in the extremes. So what does it look like? In the case of evaluating our effort and practice. I'm going to actually get to that a little later. First, I want to ask, should we evaluate our effort and practice? Can we even do that without falling into duality? Is evaluation of any kind falling into the extreme of striving, comparison, duality? And I would say yes, we do need to evaluate our practice in a certain sense. Not in the striving sense, so I'm going to be talking about how we do this without falling into the striving, the duality. But it would be a little bit like deliberately blindfolding ourselves while walking, or, you know, wearing mittens to do a fine manual task, if we just were like, I'm not going to ask how my practice is. I'm going to tune out, you know, the effectiveness or the vitality of my practice and just not even ask. Where instead of having some perception of whether we're fulfilling our own potential, whether we're practicing as diligently as we want to, or whether we're practicing with that poignant appreciation for how short life is and what a precious opportunity it is just to be alive. So it's useful in asking the question, how do I know my practice is languishing and what to do about it? Well, what do we mean by practice? So I think it's helpful to think of practice as having two aspects, form and formless aspects of practice. So form, you know, forms are things, behaviors you can see. So this is Sangha practice, attending a Dharma talk, listening to a podcast, study, taking time to reflect on the precepts, chanting, you know, it's stuff that you do. You can quantify your formal practice. Pages read, number of hours, you know, there it is. But the formless aspect of practice is an orientation toward reality you can take anywhere at any moment. So moment by moment practice is, I like to think of it as living deliberately. Instead of just being carried away by habit patterns and desires and being pushed around by the things around us, we want to live by choice. We want to explore the choices that we have to meet reality and respond with as much wisdom, compassion, and skillfulness as we can. And skillfulness being the Buddhist term for, you know, not just acting in terms of what is right and wrong, but, you know, what is the most beneficial way to meet this circumstance? What is the way to bring about the most relief from suffering and the best happiness, increase in wisdom? So in order to respond in this way, we have to perceive clearly. So this formless practice is also about, you know, mindfulness, about being open, setting aside our self-centered agendas in order to really be able to see. And once we see, we ask ourselves, what choices can I make in this moment to minimize suffering, maximize real happiness for all involved? What positive choices can I make within my own body and mind, regardless of whether circumstances change, regardless of the choices anyone else makes? So a lot of times this is a shift in our attitude, basically, that really can change things. So formal practice supports our formless practice. But it is possible to go through the formal practice, the, you know, go through the motions and not really be doing much of this formless practice either, just kind of showing up and, you know. And alternatively, there may be times where you don't have as much formal practice in your life for some reason. You know, responsibilities, illness, you know, all kinds of things can come up where, or vacations. Like when I go to visit my family in Minnesota, you know, the formal practice goes right out the window, but I will have done enough formal practice, you know, in the other parts of my life that, you know, a week or two, I can maintain that formless practice fairly well, even without the supports. So asking yourself whether your practice is languishing can be answered in terms of formal and formless practice. So the formal, you know, you just add it up. How much time? How much effort? How much engagement? It's pretty simple. You know, has your formal practice been undergoing neglect or experienced prolonged inactivity? Has it been subject to delay or disregard, or has it been ignored? So there's no required amount of participation that makes you a good Zen Buddhist. Different amounts for different people, depending on your life, your personality, your aspirations. But you know for yourself how much ends up feeling good, feeling sustainable, how much tends to sustain you. Maybe, for example, you know that trying to attend a Sangha event once a week is like ideal, that's great, but you know, three times a month, that tends to, you know, be a nice maintenance level, maybe one retreat a year or something. You have some sense of what is possible within your life, but also supportive. And then maybe you may look at that and realize, you know, in the last few months, you've, you know, barely made it to a Sangha event at all or whatever. So again, it's a judgment of your own, kind of just exactly like, you know, eating healthy and exercising and all of these things that we know, like, I know I feel better when I do this. Sometimes it's easy to fall out of the habit, but, you know, so we can kind of evaluate our practice that way. In terms of the formless practice, living deliberately moment by moment, this can't be measured. And frankly, our effort is always imperfect. It always falls short. I was thinking of in Genjo Koan, when Dogen talks about, you know, we're in the middle of the ocean and we look around, we just see a circle. You know, it's just a two-dimensional thing, it's a circle. That's our perception, but the ocean, he's like, the ocean's neither round nor square. It has infinite characteristics. You know, if you're a fish, if you're a starfish, if you're a bird, you can't possibly, no being could possibly perceive all of the ways that the ocean is. So in that sense, like, even if we're making the utmost effort, there's just we can't perceive everything perfectly, we can't respond to everything skillfully, there's always going to be limits, let alone the fact that even if we're really trying to be attentive, you know, who knows, is it 90% of the time where we're like, I'm just off on some self-referential thought pattern anyway? So, you know, once you look to evaluate your formless practice, it's elusive and humbling. So if we ask ourselves honestly, is my practice, my formal practice and my formless practice languishing? And we conclude, at least to some extent, yes, Is this just, is this the first step towards driving? Are we kind of immediately upon making that judgment just falling into that dualistic trap? Do we need, if we feel that kind of dissatisfaction arise, do we need to just like brush it off and let go of it and just say, you know, well, this is my practice, just accept it. Like the instant I accept it, it's all okay. And thereby, though, risk falling into complacency. So I think the important thing is that our sense of dissatisfaction with our own practice is information. We don't have to leap to conclusions or weave an elaborate self-centered narrative around it. We just notice, I'm thinking my practice might be languishing somewhat. And in some ways, this dissatisfaction is just a direct perception. It's like your hand sensing heat or cold. It's not objectively right or wrong. That's kind of how we, you know, go like, well, is my practice languishing? Is it not languishing? It's like I have some sense of dissatisfaction arising about my practice. You know, interesting. What's that about? So we can take that as information and look within and inquire about the state of our practice. And if we see our behavior doesn't quite match up with what we know is best for us and for others, for what we aspire to, okay, you know, now is there something we can do? So I wanted to introduce the Buddhist definition of lazy, which applies a little here. It says it's the failure to apply what is wholesome. So it's the failure to apply what is wholesome. And I like this because that means in order to be lazy, we have some sense of what is wholesome. We know what's wholesome. We know what would be good, and we're just not doing it. We're just avoiding it or not applying it. So, I mean, you can't be accused of being lazy if you have no idea that particular activity is wholesome and you're not doing it. It's really this kind of internal quandary. So why do we fail to apply what we know is wholesome or beneficial? And of course, there's many, many reasons. And most of the time, for one reason or another, we're just making different choices. We're ranking various excuses for doing other things and neglecting this wholesome thing. We're spending time on other things instead of formal practice. Or we're directing our attention to less wholesome or ultimately beneficial things moment by moment, instead of meeting each moment wholeheartedly the way we aspire to. And the sad thing about laziness, about allowing our practice to languish, it's not like a moral judgment, you're lazy. It's not about other people. It's not about comparison to some external ideal. If we're being lazy, we're not living the way that we at some level really actually want to. So we're acting out of accord with our own desires, our own deeper desires and aspirations. Now we have many competing desires, but I like to think of these deep desires as like, if you take the widest possible perspective, sometimes I like to imagine, all right, so at the end of the day, when I review the day, what will I have been happy to have done? Like, maybe in the moment, I'd prefer to keep scrolling through Facebook indefinitely. But at the end of the day, you know, what is going to have been satisfying? Or, you know, maybe at the end of your life, right? Maybe there's these tasks that you're caught up in. But when you, if you imagine, like, on the course of my life, what do I want to have taken care of? What do I want to have emphasized? So, yeah, so maybe I'm sitting there scrolling through Facebook, but I make myself get up and exercise or sit or take my dogs for a walk in the sunshine. So we can respond to our own dissatisfaction about our practice without falling into either the extreme of striving or the extreme of complacency. So falling into duality when we notice this dissatisfaction means taking it and weaving it into a narrative about the self, thinking about my practice. How is my practice doing? How does my practice fall on the spectrum between good practice and bad practice? How do I make my practice better? And falling into duality means creating concepts of good and bad practice, whether we reject those concepts or embrace them. So practicing the middle way, just not getting trapped in that duality, means to stay with your direct experience, where there's no need to conceive of what good or bad practice looks like. There's no need to measure your practice or make judgments about it. There's no need to compare yourself to others or even to some ideal that you hold. There's no need to beat yourself up or conclude that you're lazy or inadequate. Instead, you just turn that light within and recall your deepest aspirations, your utterly sincere, deepest, truest desires when you consider your human life from the largest possible perspective. And then align yourself with those desires as best you can. Because this makes practice a direction, a process, a path. So the question of whether your practice is languishing is a question of whether you are remembering to, bothering to, align yourself with your deepest aspirations. So it's totally up to you. Only you know. And how do we know when our practice is not languishing? When, contrary to languishing, it is strong, vigorous, vital, active, attended to, nurtured. We may be able to draw a few objective conclusions about our formal practice. You know, yes, I've been meditating as often as I'd like to, and, you know, I've been keeping up with some study and those kinds of things. But how do you know you're living as deliberately as you can? This is tricky, and evaluation invites us to, you know, start getting dualistic about it. So for myself, I guess, again, I mean, when I want to draw a conclusion, I can tell I'm going down that dualistic path. Like, yes, lately has been very fruitful. Like, you know, then what does that mean? And I'm comparing. But I do think there's a sense of, it's difficult to put your finger on it, but a sense of flow and a sense of growth, a sense of path that I'm continuing to engage this journey, whatever it is, that I'm not, you know, kind of hiding out or holding back, that I'm showing up as sincerely as I can. You know, there's plenty of humility in that. That's evaluation. So now we have a whole half an hour for Q&A and comments. We don't have to go that long. We can end early as well. So I will just leave it there. And if you are on Zoom, you can raise your hand using the reactions button or do it the old-fashioned way. And in the Zendo, please, as well. James.
I just wanted to thank you for that. Because when I think about my practice languishing, I do find myself falling into that, like, oh, this is bad. And then it's like, oh, but I'm picking and choosing. But then if I ignore that, then it's complacency. And so trying to find that, like, just enough dissatisfaction to motivate me to continue, but just enough of the practice, like, coming to bear and not picking and choosing to say that it's okay, like trying to find that balance between those and use it as skillfully, use that feeling of languishing, that feeling of dissatisfaction as skillfully as possible is hard to, because we're so used to say, if we're dissatisfied with something, we'll fix it, you know, and, or other people say, well, I'm dissatisfied and that's just the way it is. And then they make that part of their identity to be dissatisfied. So I really appreciate you kind of saying, you know, how do you weigh those two polar opposites of it and find that balance between the two? So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, and you remind me of, you know, I've come to count on periodically feeling dissatisfied with my practice as a good thing. I'm glad. It's like having a sense of hunger or being able to feel pain. You know, those are good things you get, that you can perceive that something is going on. And then I know, so I can rely on it. Like I know I won't fall too far into complacency, because that natural dissatisfaction, oh, come on. Time to fire it up a little bit more. Paula.
Thank you. I really found this very helpful as well, Domio, and I'm quite grateful for this conversation. When you said deep aspiration, like looking at your deep aspiration, what came up for me was like this like, for me, there's like levels of deep aspiration. So I have a deep old aspiration that's not useful, really. And that's kind of trying to please everybody outside of myself. And I tend to notice that I do that when I'm getting really exhausted and I'm suffering. And then I get really angry and frustrated and I kind of fall apart. So that is a deep aspiration I have, because I keep doing it over and subconsciously a lot of the time, although I'm becoming more. And then when you were talking about deep aspiration, I thought, well, there must be a deeper aspiration to resolve suffering in myself and in others and in my relationships with others. So there's like, is that deep aspiration that I keep running into that's not useful, that's harmful and creates suffering for myself and others. And then there's this deeper aspiration, because I kept getting hung up on that first level one of people pleasing, which isn't useful because it's burning out. And so under that is this other one of connecting to practice and resolving suffering. So thank you for that.
I like to think that almost all of our negative habits, I mean, they're kind of skewed manifestations of these deeper aspirations, you know, the deeper aspiration to, for these beings around you to have peace, right? So that's kind of a skewed, unskillful response to think, oh, well, I will just put myself aside and try to bring peace to these people. And yeah, like, I like that. It's just, they're a little bit twisted manifestations of something. It's actually quite, quite sincere. So that's where I like to, you know, sometimes we might judge certain aspects of ourselves, but if we look at it, it's like, well, I mean, it comes from a good place, even if it's not really the best way to achieve that deepest aspiration. Brian.
So between your Dharma talks and the Zen Studies podcast, I find myself thinking of the word a lot of times, first start thinking about the word. So practice, I think about, practice for what? Like you're a musician practicing for a concert, or like you're a dentist with a practice. And so both of them are sort of, what's the practice for? It's for life. The practice is, if it's languishing, then maybe what it's languishing for me is, am I being less genuine? And because that's the, whatever the Buddhist, the Buddha nature, or, when I'm doing the things I care about in relationship to the work I'm doing or family or friends, how much of the ungunked up self is involved in that? And how, am I open to being affected by other people and stuff? So I think that's a, one way to kind of look at practice, and whether it's languishing and how vital it is, and is whether, it is kind of preparing you, enabling you to be that more genuine person in the world. And then if you do find yourself languishing, then maybe that, the question that it suggests is, am I, to use one of your other words, witnessing enough? Am I in the world where I want to be enough to be effective? Like, because maybe there's a sort of a mutual dynamic between I practice to prepare, but the world also enhances my practice to the degree that I take it in and I grow with it. So anyway, you're making me an etymologist, like looking at all these words.
Thank you. Mary, and then Linda in the Zendo.
Thank you. This has been a very helpful discussion. Practice, it really boils down to practice. And then for me anyway, in my experience, and then it becomes my relationship to the practice. What things do I bring to practice that I need maybe to look at a greater distance? Because things change over time. And it's kind of like Paola was talking about. You see certain aspects of yourself when you really look at your practice and your relationship to it that you don't necessarily see when you're very involved in the doing of it. In my experience, I'm seeing I need to include in practice a broader range of what spiritual work is all about. It's always been that way. And then the second thing is the incredible value of Sangha. People connecting with each other and sharing. And, Zoom has certainly made that possible in ways that we never expected. So it's really relationship. It's all about relationship to your practice. And you need distance sometimes. We just do, which is helpful. So thank you again. It's really wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, I meant to go into that a little bit more, that kind of, that we go through these patterns where, our practice is more active in the formal and formless ways, and then sometimes where it languishes a little bit, and the formal, this is where building up habits of the formal practice is very helpful. Not only because, you know, it's literally helpful, right? You hear something inspiring, the meditation helps you, you know, live in a more sane way. Support from Sangha members is helpful. So in that sense, I mean, it's, you know, literally helpful there. But even when we might kind of go through the motions for a while, the inspiration isn't that great. If we have a habit, it's just whatever, I just go to Sangha on Sundays. it can carry us through some of these periods where, you know, we're just keeping up that habit. So it can languish a little bit, but then the habit will still be there for us to revitalize our practice, as opposed to kind of completely recreating it. It's the same with all kinds of habits, right? It's like when you're in the habit of exercising, you know it feels good and you're used to doing it, and there you go. And if you stop, it can be really hard to start again. All right, so Linda, you would come up here.
I just had a quick follow up from Brian's comments, and that I appreciate when you begin often with the definition of what we're looking at. I find that really helpful because sometimes we brush by, it's like assuming what we mean. But and then you gave a definition of lazy, a Buddhist definition of lazy. And I'm thinking, like, where did you get this definition from? Is there some Buddhist dictionary that I don't know about? Is this like a sutra dictionary that or something that I'm missing?
I honestly can't remember. And if I develop this into a podcast, then I'll be trying to look it up. I think it might have been some, you know, like tricycle article by a Vajrayana teacher or something like that. But chances are good, like I can just type in Buddhist and lazy in Google and, you know, something will come up. But I love that, because I looked up the dictionary definition today, and it's, of course, you know, doesn't like work and, you know, averse to discipline and, you know, these various negative kind of things. But it's like, and it's like the lazy means you have the potential, right? You're,
you know better.
Yeah. Dave.
So, because I'm a huge dork, when you said that, I actually went on the internet and tried to find the source for that. And the only one I can find is an essay from you dated July 17th, 2014. So where it came before that, I don't know. But the only source on the internet is your own essay.
Oh, no. Maybe I came up with it. I mean, I usually do I not cite the source in that essay?
Not in this particular one. It's entitled "Am I Practicing Hard Enough?" from 2014. So go check that out. But I just wanted to comment. I mean, I appreciate you helping me reclaim that word, because I have always been accused of being a lazy person. And this is something that I've grown to embrace. You know, just as a young person, oh, Dave, you're so smart. You could accomplish so much if you weren't so lazy. Or you could make so much money if you weren't so lazy. And in future, when anybody says something like that, I'm going to say, well, I'm not lazy. I am merely wholeheartedly, you know, practicing, you know, what was the phrase? I'm wholeheartedly practicing what is wholesome, right? And that might not mean in my life getting up really early in the morning to clock into work, but I still feel that I'm going to embrace your definition, as you stated.
Yeah, it makes me think of, there's this beautiful, I think it's called Amongst White Clouds, I could be wrong, but I think it's a documentary about hermit monks in China who just live off on a mountainside, you know, but they don't have a sangha, they just live their simple life and silence, lots of meditation, and you're like, I don't know. And they're not even like, ooh, they get up crack of dawn and they meditate. They're just living. And sometimes I think, you know, I don't even know that I'd be capable of that, of just wholeheartedly just being. No, you're not useful. You have no status. You have no externally defined purpose. Dennis, if you'd just go ahead.
This is not a fully formed thought, but I'm going to run with it. To kind of delta off of what Brian was saying, everybody wants to quantify. And I think there may be an opening to actually do that. I mean, I think if you follow the precepts and you see yourself following the precepts and responding with wisdom and compassion reflexively, it's like, well, that's progress, you know? And in the book we're reading, the precepts, I can't remember the name offhand, but finding yourself in the dead space, you know, and going in the right direction instead of firing off that aggressive or angry comment. You say, yeah, I got two ways to go here. I'm going to go this way. And if you go the right way enough times, it's like, that's progress.
I don't know. Yeah. I think what you're describing is similar to what I meant by a sense of path and growth, that we really can, you know, without getting all wrapped up in a dualistic sense of progress, and now I'm, you know, but we see changes. If we didn't see changes, and we have to, you know, not be too picky about how fast those changes happen or exactly where those changes happen, but, you know, that is a sign that we really are, our practice is really vital when we're noticing, you know, I was a little bit less reactive at that moment. Or, you know, a couple years ago, this thing would have really, you know, freaked me out. Or, wow, you know, I can just relax and be mindful in this situation as opposed to having to, you know, think all the time.
Or what's probably more common for myself is, geez, I should have done it this way. I should have said that instead of this. Yeah, so, but anyway, that's...
Yeah.
Yeshe Tsoki. I was just wondering, I thought you gave a talk about the Buddhist term sloth and torpor. Mm. I'm wondering if you mentioned your definition or talk more about lazy in that talk. I think you did. Maybe I'm imagining it.
I'll have to check it out, because I think I did a podcast or two on the hindrances, which the sloth and torpor is. So good, good heads up. Victor.
The way you split practice between formal and informal practice, I think it's really useful for me. And I start to think about it and how it's easy, so easy to quantify and to see progress in formal practice. As you mentioned, it's a matter of engagement and of the time you invest in it. And at the same time, I was thinking, how can I improve my informal practice? Not exactly measure it, but improve it. And I realized that in the last weeks, last months, there were two things that helped me with that. One was that How to Train a Wild Elephant book, because it introduces something that it's really small in my routine, a weekly practice, and it's it breaks my action-reaction pattern that I use all day long. So when I have to remember for example, to look to, for, look at something with loving eyes, or when I have to remember to breathe for 3 times when the bell rings at some interval times during the day. It's a way to bring practice for my routine and to break the pattern. And another thing that has been very helpful for me, it's the precepts. Because they arise during the day. I can say that, I'm modeling all my actions by them, but I remember them. Most of times after doing something, I shouldn't have done it. But they bring awareness to my day. So that's it. Just want to share that. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's what I do love about Diane Rossetto's book on the precepts, because she does frame the precepts this way. It's almost like a mindfulness tool. You know, when we notice we've broken a precept, or we're breaking a precept, or we want to break a precept, you know, it's just this, what did she say? It's like the sign above the door, or the warning flag, or something like that. She says, like, it's, you know, pay attention. And then, you know, like you said, it's all day long. I mean, all day long, you're not doing zazen all day long. You're not contemplating the emptiness of self all day long. You're in relationship with the world and people and things, and that's where the precepts come up. So, yeah. And for people who don't know, the How to Train a Wild Elephant is a book by Chozen Bays that includes a bunch of mindfulness exercises that she came up with at the monastery. They would practice these at the monastery for a week at a time. And so these different recommendations of things to commit to throughout the course of your day, like, you know, taking a few breaths before you answer the phone, or, you know, there's something about, you know, every time you pass through a doorway, you do something or something like that. So you just use these little daily triggers for mindfulness bells. Dave.
Yeah, it has been a great discussion. You have heard of Richard Baker, who was Suzuki Roshi's first transmission. He put practice down to two words, and one is intention and the other one is attention. And so when I start my practice in the morning, I start with the intention. What's the intention in doing this? And so if it starts to languish a little, it's like, I need to renew the attention, intention. And then during the practice that I do in the morning, I pay attention to it. And I find those two words really help me, not to achieve, I'm not really trying to achieve, but to do it as best I can. So anyway, just those two words seem to help a lot.
Rosemary, did you put your hand back down?
Yeah, sorry, my computer's going mad. I have nothing to say. I'm just fascinated with listening. Sorry.
All right. Fair enough. I guess it'd be worth mentioning also, it's kind of another topic. But, you know, if we have decided that in some sense our practice is languishing and we'd like to reconnect with our intention, bring more attention to our practice, stop ignoring it, make some more time for it, whatever, you know, there's definitely a lot of skillfulness required in terms of what we then try to do. You know, how do we make changes and take action without falling into striving? My example of this is, like, this has been one of my central koans, is kind of effort and non-effort, because I felt immense dissatisfaction about my life and my practice, and I was going to, you know, bear down until it was resolved. Ah, you know, like, so if it could be done that way, I think I would have been able to do it. But I began to think of myself more as like a bonsai tree. So I have an intention. I want to have a certain form come out, but I cannot just go in and, you know, go like, I'm a living thing. I have a shape already. I have tendencies already. I cannot be remade overnight. So, like, we have an aspiration, we have an intention, but we have to make, like, living use of ourselves. We have to be compassionate and patient, and yet not, like, it's not like, well, it's going to take a long time to shape this tree, so I just won't shape it at all. I'll just let it grow, and, you know, then it's, I mean, maybe you don't like bonsai, but it's not a bonsai if you just let it grow and you didn't discipline it at all. So so that's like the two extremes, right? Just let your tree grow however it wants to grow. Or, you know, like you've tried so hard, you've wired those branches and you tried to shape it, and like the tree's gonna die. You've just pushed it so hard. So somehow in the middle, we want to be, in case anybody's, you know, ready to go fix their languishing practice, I'll leave with that little advice. All right, I will say our closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond, thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming.